questions about inequality, about inclusivity, about whose voices are heard, they're not going to go away, and we do have to address them.
Hello and welcome to the third in our short series of podcasts looking at decolonising the curriculum. We started by hearing from Claire Hines at UEA, who is talking about the challenge we all face in decolonising the curriculum. And today we're going to look further at that, what the next step should be for all of us in tackling that ingrained racism. As in the previous episodes, I'm joined by five members of Eastern Arc, three members of staff and two students. Barbara Odewumi is a postdoctoral research associate in student success at Kent. She's joined by the student intern on the Diversity Mark project, Patrice Myton. Hannah Gibson is a senior lecturer in linguistics at Essex, and Claire Hines is a lecturer in literature and creative writing at UEA. She's joined by a member of the BIPOC student ambassador scheme there, Amy Ibarra-Hempel. I started by picking up on something which we discussed right at the beginning, which was when UEA announced a discussion around decolonising the curriculum. They managed to fill a lecture hall with people who are interested in finding out more. I wanted to pose the question, was that an initial response to something that hadn't been there before? And over time, will become less, so there'll be less people who have that interest because perhaps it will be normalised, the curriculum will be more balanced. Or do you think it's something which will continue to draw people in and which people will continue to engage with?
I think people will continue to engage with this issue. I think that there were murmurings before the panel event that I ran from staff, from students, you know, people kind of asking questions about curriculums and the diversity of the staff. But then the thing is that there are resonances with what's going on in the wider world. So it's not only that we've got, Rhodes Must Fall, Why Is My Curriculum White? We have events going on, for instance, George Floyd being an obvious example, which mean that these questions are raised again. And, you know, at the moment we've got this issue around Meghan Markle and Harry, which is in the news, which might seem like, okay, well, that's the royal family and it's just a kind of popular discussion. But I think it raises questions for us as educators in terms of, you know, why is the level of race literacy around these discussions so low? And I'm sure students are asking questions as well. You know, there are just so many questions being asked in society. The questions in the publishing industry, questions about students and how prepared they are to work in a world which is diverse. If we continue to have an education system which is very restricted, that kind of elevates a very few number of white middle class male writers or thinkers, then it doesn't help us to really understand society. It doesn't help us to be creative. It doesn't help us to really live in a very full and positive way. And it has enormous implications for society. So I think, you know, if we connect up what we're doing in the university and think about questions in society, you know, even in terms of things like COVID, we can see as well the inequalities in the wider community. We can see the inequalities in terms of universities, for instance, participation. Who is impacted most at this time? Where are those inequalities? And they've widened. You know, we're seeing that who are the people who are suffering more in terms of well-being and mental health? Who are the people who are able to participate in terms of online learning who aren't? All of these questions about inequality, about inclusivity, about whose voices are heard, they're not going to go away. And we do have to address them. And we've had, you know, some very uncomfortable discussions as well. And this hasn't been easy. It's a very, very difficult process. So we're really trying on a number of different levels to push forward on this issue. But I think the calls to decolonize are just going to get stronger. They're not going to go away.
Thanks, Claire. Something you mentioned just
just struck me, the pace at which this is going. Do you think it's going fast enough? Is it sluggish, essentially, or do you feel it's going at a pace that is natural and brings people on board? Or is there a sense of impatience? This has been going on for decades, hundreds of years. Why can't it happen more quickly?
I think there's definitely an impatience from students, quite rightly so, who are wanting to see changes now. And, you know, they've got every reason to think in that way. And on a personal level, I'd like to see change happen really, really quickly and happen immediately. But I'm thinking about things on a sort of more practical level and in terms of my experience being on this earth quite a long time and seeing writing about race and seeing how conversations develop. In some ways, I think, yes, we could have, you know, change might happen really quickly and then things go back in time. Things go back and things aren't so progressive. And I think, you know, I've seen that in my lifetime. I've seen Stephen Lawrence murder. I was involved in reporting on that and involved in the McPherson inquiry and being part of that reporting on that, and then seeing that you know, this big kind of momentum develop around sort of racism, institutional racism, and people's kind of willingness to see change, and then a kind of dropping off, or, you know, I don't know, there's a recession and people aren't so interested anymore, or something else happens in their life. So I think I'd love to see change happen really quickly, but I think, if I'm honest, I think it's going to take some time, and it's a process. I mean, when do we ever say, okay, yeah, we're there now? It is going to take time.
And I think that point about sustainability is an important one, isn't it? That, you know, you don't want radical change too quickly and then for it to slide. Hannah, right at the beginning, you mentioned as part of the background to the movement, that issue, the Roads Must Fall movement, and then going further to the Fees Must Fall. And the question about perhaps widening participation of bringing people of colour into higher education and also closing that attainment gap. Do you see that happening? Do you see the decolonizing the curriculum as a way of doing that? What else could universities, could we all be doing to address that?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I have found myself saying on numerous occasions that kind of discussions around decolonizing the curriculum and issues around the award gap, and particularly for Black and minority ethnic students and white students, are separate issues. And I think they are related. And so it's, you know, like to hear, I mean, it's also like heartbreaking and familiar to hear Patrice say, you know, you don't see yourself recognised in materials, and some of the experiences you talked about as well, Amy. So there is issues of like belonging and, you know, place and who is here and do I see myself reflected. And I have no doubt that that has an impact on, you know, how you do at university, what you achieve, what you think you can do, how you're treated. But we also know, for example, that the, you know, so-called award gap is different in different subjects. And so, you know, STEM subjects kind of broadly seem to have different issues or different issues in different places. It seems to be in many ways more subjective subjects where those issues play out. And so on one hand, we could say, okay, we've been talking quite a lot here about reading, right? So writers and who's on reading lists, and perhaps in literature, you know, these are very relevant kind of issues. I've also had sort of discussions or pushback from people in what you might think of as sciences. And in a way, I think I'm a linguist, and I think linguists have for a long time also sat on our laurels thinking, oh, well, this is just true or false. You know, you can't decolonize some of this knowledge. And so, you know, what we know about cell biology, what we know about maths, there is no place for decolonizing the curriculum here. And I strongly disagree, but I think it picks up on something that Claire was saying. So I think this is a really long-standing piece of work. I think it's a journey, it's a process. I don't know if there is a destination, but I do think that we should be doing almost immediately some very basic things that you can do across all subjects. So I have said, I think we all need to situate, as teachers, as educators, we should all be situating ourselves in the knowledge that we teach. So it doesn't matter what subject you're teaching. And in a way, perhaps it doesn't matter if 100% of the people on your reading list are white men who were born within a 50-year period of each other, if that is the subject of the course. But what I would like is education for someone who's teaching that course to say at the beginning of the class, everyone in this reading list is a white man, and have the confidence to say that and to explain why. And then talk about the fact that there are, yes, lots of, you know, black people, lots of people from the global majority, global south, who have written about these topics as well. And, you know, that sort of should be part of that discussion. I think Barbara made a nice point here about like core reading and, you know, beyond core reading. And I think those are both like, they're quite difficult things to deal with, but we have again a great opportunity to say, well, this is why this is the core. This is why you need to know this stuff. This is things you need to know to go on to the next level. And so to kind of come back to the, you know, the award gap and who is at university, I think for me, and maybe I'm just, you know, radical on this front, but like, I think for me, decolonizing the curriculum or decolonizing the university more broadly is asking for a much more wholesale shakeup of what we think knowledge is. Not just who writes about it or who gets funded to write about it, what grades we get given for doing so. Like, what do we need to know about the world? What should I learn by the end of 3 years, 4 years? And still, this is really based in a very old kind of conceptualization of knowledge and power, which is based on empire and colonialism and racism, like, you know, huge systems, but also like massive class inequalities, right? This is also something that was very much entrenched through kind of colonial endeavors and on to today. We should be talking about class inequalities. We should be talking about gender, gender identities that are, you know, recognized, celebrated, were erased. So really, I think decolonizing the curriculum is asking for something that I actually almost can't quite imagine, because I'm being subject to this for my entire education as well. Like, and I think, you know, Patrice and Amy and the work that colleagues here are doing, I always say, like, I think it's amazing that the students are demanding more, because in a way you get to university and you're what, like 17, 18, 20, 30. For most of us, this is all we know. This is what education has always been. And yet they're saying, wait a minute, this isn't good enough. There's something else out there. And I think like that alone is like inspiring. And I think means that we have to do better. And it's great that there's these collaborations between students, between staff, a lot of this work going on behind the scenes to hold us to account, because it's not good enough. And of course that means you want it changed by next year, but I don't even know quite where we're heading to personally. That's why sort of, I don't know if that's good news or bad news, but yeah.
I think it's news. I think it's a very valid point. And that point about the need for whole, as you described, the wholesale shake-up of the system, and also for people, white, male, privileged, people of a certain age, to be honest and upfront and recognise where that privilege, that particular viewpoint comes from. It leads me on to, I guess, my final question, which is something Claire raised prior to this recording, about how we can encourage staff and students from all backgrounds to become more engaged in anti-racist work. She made the point about there are fears perhaps amongst white colleagues and students about using the wrong language or causing offence. I'd be interested to get your thoughts on that. Amy, can I come to you first? I just saw you nodding.
I would say absolutely, like Claire kind of raised, there is a huge fear of making a mistake, of messing up, of saying something that isn't quite right, which comes from a good place, understandably. It's great that people don't want to be offensive. However, we need to have uncomfortable conversations for people to learn. And the way you learn is through making mistakes. And I think there's, within both from staff and students, there is a fear of saying something that might be wrong. And that kind of leads to a tiptoeing around all of these issues, around racial discrimination, around kind of decolonizing of a very white curriculum. And particularly for some members of staff, that can result in not really addressing the topic at all, particularly within the classroom when they're teaching seminars, even when they're teaching texts that quite explicitly talk about race and racial discrimination. So something that we've been quite focused on is trying to encourage, especially teaching staff, that the most important thing to acknowledge the fact that there is racial discrimination. For example, in the text we read, there is a white canon that our school is sticking to. There is a lot of change that needs to be done in what is being taught, how it's being taught in the classroom, because it's not good enough. It's worse to just pretend like it's not there. Because when you're a student of color or an ethnic minority sat in that classroom, being your seminar leader not saying anything about something that is clearly in the text you're reading, it's, I can't really describe how it feels. It's horrible, and it makes you feel unwelcome to a certain extent, because it's so clear to you, and you know that you want your kind of teacher who's there to bring you the knowledge, you want them to say something, and when they don't, it's a huge disappointment. And it's not good enough. So, like I said, we've been kind of trying to encourage people to start somewhere, because everyone has to start somewhere. And it's okay to ask questions, and it's okay to try and formulate your thoughts. And if you mess up, then we'll correct you, and that's okay. And then you take that on board, and everyone goes about their day. Something that we've done in the past, which I thought was quite helpful, was last year we hosted a workshop for members of staff, a decolonizing literature workshop. Myself and our former ambassador, Erica, we ran this workshop, and we basically had a conversation with members of staff about what it's like from a student perspective to have to learn a colonized curriculum, and what it's like to read, for example, a canonical text that is racist, because that happens quite often in our kind of degree in English literature. And yeah, a lot of members of staff said that they found it really helpful to hear from students of color directly how it affects them in the classroom when these topics aren't addressed. We had some really productive discussions within the workshop, and I hope that generally the members of staff who attended have been able to kind of go on from that workshop being able to acknowledge their shortcomings and where they need to do better and where they need to learn more. Because, you know, I can't speak for all students of color, but I think it is really important to us that our members of staff, especially white members of staff, admit that work needs to be done and that they're trying, because, you know, they have to. So.
That's so important and such a valuable place to end. I love, once again, that quote that we need to have uncomfortable conversations in order for people to learn, and that we can't tiptoe around, and we shouldn't tiptoe around the issues. We should recognise them and face them.
So thank you to all the speakers who took part today, Barbara, Patrice, Hannah, Claire and Amy. I also want to thank everyone who is involved in the production of this podcast, including Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin of Purple Planet Music. And thank you too for tuning in to the Eastern Art podcast series. Join us again next time when we continue to explore the issues, the research, the ideas and the commonalities between each of the Eastern Arc universities.